Hi, this is Philip Meyer, welcoming you to another episode of Talking About Platforms.
And we are Daniel Trabucchi
and Thomas Buganza, the co-hosts of this podcast, where we present and discuss relevant discoveries from the field of platform research.
In every episode, we have a guest sharing with us one of his or her latest insights on platforms, starting from a paper, a project, or a book to make it accessible to everyone.
And with that, let's just jump right into the conversation. Welcome to a new episode of the Talking About Platforms podcast. My name is Philip Meyer, and I'm here today first with my regular co-host, Daniel Trabucchi. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, everyone.
And with today's guest, Andre Hagio. Hi, Andre.
Hello, everybody. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. Let me briefly say a few words about Andre. Andre is an associate professor in information systems at Boston University. He further runs the Platform Chronicles blog together with Julian Wright, and advisor and consultants for startups building platform business models, as well as large companies seeking to turn products into platforms. Andre, would you like to add something to this short introduction?
I think that pretty much sums it. So basically, I approach platforms from many different directions, obviously academically, but I also find it very fun to do some consulting and obviously some angel investing in platform startups.
So I think we can start with our usual first question. The idea of the podcast is to have people talking about platforms, but we are highly aware that not all the people talking about platforms are actually meaning exactly the same thing. So we'd like to know, what's a platform to you, which is the definition you are usually referring to, and also to get a bit more personal, to know how you end up studying platforms, how you end up in this world.
Sure. Very simply, I think of platform businesses essentially as businesses that enable some sort of interactions between their customers. I think that's as simple as precise as I can make it. So obviously that includes marketplaces, the interactions or transactions between buyers and sellers, but it also includes social networks, communication platforms, where the interaction is communication or other kinds of social interaction. And how did I get into this? Well, it's very simple. When I did my PhD, I think there were the first couple papers on platforms had just appeared. So from the Toulouse School of Economics. And I ended up doing my PhD dissertation on platform businesses. And I never looked back because it was interesting then, and it only became more interesting over time.
Right. Thank you so much for sharing. So I remember that your multi-sided markets paper was one of the first that I read. Well, the multi-sided platforms paper was one of the first that I read and got really like interested in the topic. And since you did a lot of work, especially when it comes to figuring when and how a platform gets more or less attractive for complementers or users in general to join a platform, maybe you can give me like a brief rundown on your latest thoughts on what the platform from a central perspective can do, should do, and especially, I think this is one topic you're working on, avoiding traps that they can tap into.
Sure. So the latest research project that I'm working on is indeed called Platform Traps. And the idea is, for many platforms, I think in particular marketplaces, once they become dominant, there is this sense that, let's say, if you're a seller, a restaurant on food delivery platforms, a hotel on booking.com, or a seller on Amazon, there's a sense in which at some point, if the platform is dominant, you're trapped in a sense that you really don't have a choice not to be on the platform. Because of the strong network effects, you depend on the platform to get lots of customers. And therefore, the platforms, these dominant platforms, can increase their fees, ask the sellers to advertise, which is another form of extracting more fees, They can redesign the platform to make competition between sellers more intense. And again, you don't really have a choice. You have to participate, right? So in that sense, there's a trap. It's a voluntary. So the interesting question is, like, are sellers myopic? Don't they understand this from the, you know, from the beginning when they joined? I'm sure in reality, there's some myopia. Like, some people are like, okay, I love the platform, I'll join. And then I end up, you know, maybe I'm overly optimistic and I end up being trapped on the platform. But what we show in the paper is that you don't actually need to assume any type of myopia or irrationality. Like, sellers can be perfectly forward-looking, understand the mechanism, and yet what's individually rational for each seller just to join the platform ends up hurting all sellers collectively. And so it's like, once all the sellers have joined, we've basically given all the power to the platform, because each of us, when we join, like, we give a little bit more power to the platform. And then the platform is so powerful that then they can extract power fees from all of us. That's basically the idea. And I think it's fairly realistic. I mean, it does happen. It does happen in practice. I mean, it's interesting to speculate. There are some platforms that appear to be more exploitative than others once they become dominant. So, for example, I think most food platforms are among the most hated. I think both restaurants and consumers kind of hate them because they charge phantom fees and fees are too high and so on. Others may be less so they're not abusing their power as much.
What I thought when I read about it is, on the one hand, you have the situation that on some platforms, or let's say under the umbrella of can there be a need for governance changes and more value distribution versus capture that comes from, let's say, inside the ecosystem, or does it always have to be regulated from outside the system? That's basically
So I feel very strongly about this one. It's like, I absolutely don't think this means government should intervene. Like, we make this very clear in the paper. I think we strongly, like, again, I think it's interesting and it's useful to have in mind that there's a platform trap, like, for, you know, for strategy purposes. I don't think that this somehow should be interpreted as, oh my God, like, platforms are exploitative. We need to have somewhat government regulation of the fees. I mean, that would be really silly. So, I mean, there are good reasons to regulate platforms, but just because the platforms essentially network effects over time give platforms power, I don't think that's a good enough reason. So there are certain anti-competitive actions that platforms take, which I think by now we understand fairly well. You know, they've been studied, you know, we look at them elsewhere. So I would go after those. In the sense, like, I think, for example, imposing price parity rules or, there's a lot of forcing exclusivity or things like that. I think those should be investigated. But the idea that somehow government regulators should intervene to regulate the fees, I'm extremely skeptical of that.
No, I totally agree. I thought, second thought about how the actors on the platform, why is there no more like collective action initiative to try to build a, let's say, a counterweight in, be it the restaurants or...
Yeah, I think that's an interesting topic. So, by the way, there are examples of this. So it's kind of funny. It's a bit, I don't know, if you want to make this really fun, you can say, like, you know, sellers on exploited sellers on all platforms unite. But there are examples. So there are, for example, I think developers for iOS, for Apple, there's something like a collective association of developers who are, like, really unhappy with Apple policies. I mean, again, for good reason, right? Apple imposes what's perceived as very arbitrary policies, which many developers hate. And there's been pushback. Of course, there's the Epic versus Apple, very public, high profile lawsuit, but there are others who basically, like, push back on Apple. There's another example I remember seeing, restaurants operating on Zomato, which is basically one of the major food delivery platforms in India. They completely rebelled and they boycotted the platform in Mumbai. This was like a few years ago. They said they don't like some of the policies of Zomato was basically like they perceived them as commoditizing the restaurants or like forcing them to give discounts. And they just collectively said, we're going to boycott Zomato for, I don't know, like several days or a week. So it's interesting. There are some examples of collective action. I'm sure there's going to be more as, you know, as kind of sellers realize, okay, well, the platform has a lot of power, what can they do? And yeah, I think that's a very reasonable, let's say, like market-driven mechanism to discipline platforms.
While like as a direct reaction to that, if I think about it, so I worked for the Volkswagen Group for a few years, and the Volkswagen Group is probably like the company with the strongest labor union representation. They're like, they send like half of the board is like labor representatives, and the union is not just well organized, but if they go on strike, they also compensate you for the time that you are not compensated from the company while you're on strike. So they have some mechanisms to make it easier for you to go on strike. While when I think about these restaurants in Mumbai, if there's no other marketplace for them to tap into, they also probably have to cope with 1 month long, like affected business.
Right? Any orders. Actually, that's interesting. So what would the equivalent be? Let's think about, so what would the equivalent be here? Obviously, I mean, again, short, I don't think this is the government's role to like give subsidies or something like that to whatever, compensate restaurants for boycotting platforms. That would be, but yeah, I think, so in the case of restaurants, it's tough, right? Because yeah, they're basically giving up on say food delivery orders, which for some of them, it's like, it's certainly very costly, right? That's why it required like collective boycott. In other cases, you can, I mean, in some cases, you can think about the various, let's call them players or agents or sellers on the platform. Maybe there's an opportunity to create an alternative, right? I don't think it's always true, but sometimes, like, is it possible to say we're going to go to an alternative platform that exists or create our own? I mean, it's tough. You can't possibly expect restaurants to say, like, we're going to create a competitor to Zomato. But what would be a good example of this? I guess I was talking to one of my colleagues about this in the context of education. So the concern, for example, that universities might end up, but they give all this content to edX, Coursera, and other online learning platforms. And it's an interesting question, like, should universities get, like some universities get together and create their own platforms that they kind of control in order to,
I think
to avoid being, you know, to avoid being held up by a third party platform.
I think the Black Caps in London did something to the Black Cab taxis in London. Their own thing.
Uber. Yeah. I mean, yes, they probably should have done this, right? I mean, there's nothing, I'm not going to say Uber's not complicated, but I mean, they've been doing this for a while. I think if taxis were a little bit more forward-looking, they could have tried to do an alternative.
We had in the last season a guest that was talking about platform cooperatives that are somehow going in this direction. So having the supply side that get together and try to manage a new platform. But since you start talking, my mind went back to one of your very early papers. That was one of the first thing I read when I started my PhD. And you were the one introducing me to the concept of multi-homing. So the fact that the same supplier can stay on multiple platforms. And so my mind start thinking about platforms that were popping up in the early 2000s. And then platforms that pop up today. And I don't know if you agree, but I kind of see quite empirically at this point, the idea of winners takes it all. So even though at the beginning, there are many multiple competing platforms that are somehow succeeding, the probability that one is emerging in a couple of years, it's quite important. You mentioned food delivery. I don't know the situation in the States, but in Italy, we had a couple of years in which we had like five quite big and quite popular competing platforms. But today we are basically back at one plus Just Eat that kind of hold it from the early games. I was wondering, in your study and in your reasoning on these topics, have you seen something changing from the supply side perspective over the last 20 years? So from the first platforms kind of emerging to what is emerging today, do you see a different awareness, or are we still trapped in the same traps in a way?
So I definitely think there's probably more awareness of the entire, let's call it the whole life cycle of platforms. In a sense, maybe early on, most potential participants were more focused, okay, platforms are amazing because I will be on a platform, I can get access to customers. I think part of the issue, part of the idea for this platform trap paper is that I think people kind of now can understand, it's like, okay, well, initially platforms are great because they bring me more customers, but they also put me next to more competitors, and therefore I may end up being commoditized. So I think there's definitely more awareness now that, you know, there's a trade-off with platforms. It's great for bringing more customers, but it also, again, there's more competition. There's all kinds of downsides, even as a participant. So I definitely think people and businesses understand this more. Whether you can do something about it is a separate question. With respect to winner take all, I mean, this is tough. Like, I mean, it's tough to support empirically, but I guess someone could do a study. My sense is that winner take all, and again, this is also colored by the experience I have with my co-author Julian, looking at lots of startups and investing. Winner take all is exceptionally rare. Like, I think it's actually getting more and more rare. It's quite, I mean, and you can ask, like, why is that? Maybe part of it is like multi-homing is easier. Maybe there's new technologies as well that emerge. For example, one thing that just came to mind as you were talking about platform cooperatives. I mean, it's obviously one thing that's going to make, how to say, the idea of Stellar provided platforms easier is blockchain, right? I mean, there's this notion, I mean, there's a whole movement inside the blockchain community that says, you know, Airbnb, Uber, and all these Amazon, these dominant platforms, they're bloodsuckers. They're like, they get paid way too much. We're going to create a platform based on blockchain with much lower fees because everything's on the blockchain. We don't need the Airbnbs of the world. I mean, I think that's a bit extreme. I think that platforms play an important roles, but there's definitely some value to the idea that with technologies like blockchain, some of the let's call it some of the sources of value provided by platforms might be going away. Like, there are certain things that you can enforce, like via blockchain technology, that you no longer necessarily need the platform to do. So if you look, for example, on platforms that are built on blockchain, their fees are way lower. So I'm thinking, like, say NFT marketplaces like OpenSea, their fees they charge are like 2%. Versus think about the fees that are charged by quote unquote traditional platforms like Airbnb and Uber is like more like 20%, right? So I think there's a sense in which those fees will go down with more and more with, you know, new technologies. I'm trying to think, like, for multi-homing, is there a reason to believe that multi-homing is getting easier? I mean, by the way, there are, so this is actually, I just remember there's a whole host of companies. So if you think about, for example, think about ride sharing and even Airbnb. There are now companies that provide software which make it easier for drivers or riders to more easily switch and compare prices between platforms. There's definitely, so there are companies that provide software that make it easier for restaurants to manage food delivery across DoorDash, Grubhub, and multiple platforms. So this is, there's a whole industry basically, which is providing products that make multi-homing easier. There's no question about that. So I think that definitely what makes it harder to go to winner take all, I think.
That's interesting. I often thought about the platform aggregators or anyhow those services that show you the conditions on various platforms from the demand side. But there are many on the supply side, yeah, and this has a direct impact of on
A lot. Like, there's even more value on the, I mean, you're probably thinking like Kayak and stuff like that, but they're definitely like small, maybe smaller companies that just help, especially for small businesses. Like, you want to be present on multiple platforms, and it just give you software to make it easy to manage orders on multiple platforms.
And somehow, even though it's slightly different, even the aggregators for social media platforms that you create one content and you send it out to many, and
That's true.
similarly,
For I know in the music industry there are many services that are aggregating the chance to be on almost all the streaming platforms in a while. That's definitely having an impact in
that. That's a good point. I'm sure there's services like this for, I don't know, for example, you have a podcast, like there's probably some service that allows you, okay, well, you put it on Spotify, on iTunes, and maybe take short snippets and put them on, I don't know, TikTok or whatever, or YouTube or something.
Yeah, we are using a service called Podigy, which is a great service. Happy to advertise for them, but they do exactly that, right? So we upload the file like at one hosting service and then just sign up for all the different distributors, and then it gets automatically spread.
There we go. Yeah, very nice.
You mentioned the blockchain topic. What I'm wondering there is that although you as a user probably have more agency over or more influence over the overall system than compared to let's say a centralized web 2.0, if you want, so a platform, on the other hand, you still make a very, very significant decision in adopting one protocol or the other, right? So I think if you're betting on the wrong protocol and then invest more effort than it is compared to joining a centralized platform, because the platform does more, I think. So you have less effort to be, let's say, functional on a centralized platform versus being functional on a blockchain or a distributed ledger based platform on average. So it's typically easier to sign up somewhere than like on a Web 2 platform than on a Web 3 platform. So are you aware of any work on like this decision because we brought this up, to assess the, let's say, potential or how to make the decision for one protocol or the other?
That's a really interesting topic. It's funny because I use this. I'm not aware of any research on it, but I definitely use it in my teaching. And in fact, I tend to give exam questions, which are kind of interesting. So like platforms that are built on blockchain. And one of the main points I try to make is that there's a difference between there's the network effect at the blockchain level. And you can think of a specific blockchain, say Ethereum, as a platform, which, by the way, it's an open platform. And then, of course, you can build a platform on top of that. And the point is, I think it's very important not to confuse the two and to realize, I mean, the fact that the underlying platform has network effects does not mean that those network effects transfer to the platform that you build on top of it. So in that regard, I still think it's true that platforms built on, say, blockchain are going to have less, let's call it stickiness, or like less dominance than platforms that are built like Web 2 platforms. So you're right. And there's a sense of like, okay, well, I need to choose the correct blockchain. But I mean, in a lot of I guess it depends on the context. Do you necessarily need to think about which blockchain are you choosing, or is basically the platform you're going to use is going to be built on some blockchain? I guess in order for this to work, maybe like, well, let me paint the picture that's, I guess blockchains and blockchain enthusiasts would have, and that would say commoditized platforms. So I think that's what's kind of interesting. So it's like we have this idea that platforms are very powerful, and blockchain is certainly a force that kind of reduces the power of platforms. So what would that look like? So I think the idea is everybody, like users and perhaps even sellers, instead of having a profile, let's say, which is specific to the platform. So let's say you have an Airbnb account and all your ratings are you're an Airbnb account. And like, for example, I want a multi-home. Well, my ratings for an Airbnb are not going to transfer, of course, because they're specific to Airbnb, right? Well, in the blockchain world, you can imagine everybody, including suppliers and users, maybe you have an account which is at the blockchain level. And then basically the platform, so you don't have this, that's not specific to one platform, right? And then basically like the platform just allows you to connect and to match with people who are connected to that platform. So then the value of the platform is, I mean, I think there's value, for example, discovery, right? So like a platform can specialize. I'm just going to make the best algorithm, best matching algorithm or discovery between users and suppliers who have, who have their accounts or their profiles based on blockchain. But you can see how the value of the platform is much, much less than the traditional web too, right? And it's easier for you to multi-home between multiple platforms.
No, on this, I would have a curiosity. A few years ago, now it's getting old quite quickly, we wrote a paper on blockchain and the impact that blockchain could have on platform business models. And the initial findings were pretty coherent with what you said. So fees are going down, the role of the platform provider, or how we want to call it, that builds on top of the blockchain, it's kind of getting aside, being less central, being less relevant in the communication between sides. But thinking back to those interviews a few years later, it seems to me that many of the points that those founders were actually pointing out were ideological. Like, we believe in a platform that behave in this way, that has lower fees, that gives power to the community. And then, thanks to Philip, I must say, I read The Cloud Empire by Vili Leonvirta, highly suggested book, that tells the story of many Web2 platforms. And if you go back in the history, the usual vision at the beginning was, let's help people finding each other.
Yeah, platforms for the people. Back to the people.
Yeah, and so the question is, how much is the technology that is pushing that? And how much is a governance decision, a business need?
This is very interesting. So by the way, I agree. And that was my impression as well. There's a lot of, I first saw this. I mean, some of these views are very extreme. I mean, you look at how they portray platforms, and again, it's like blood sucking. It's, you can change the word slightly, and they say it's blood sucking imperialists, right? It's like, and the blockchain is going to solve all your problems. And the reality is, like, I think my sense, like, they're kind of underestimating the true value that platforms provide. Like, it's not that easy to say, oh, I'm just going to put everything on blockchain. It's like, it's a little bit more complicated than that. Like, there's escrow and dispute resolution. It's not quite as simple. And I think you're right. If you look today, it's like, let's just look at platforms built on blockchain. Like, how many truly big, promising platforms do you have in blockchain? And it's like, I can't see that many, right? I mean, I'm familiar with this one because Julian and I invested in it, OpenSea. So OpenSea is good. Like, it's a platform. I guess it's by definition on blockchain because it's an old marketplace for NFTs. So it's not surprising. But if you say, like, is there something like Uber, like Airbnb built on the blockchain? Like, you know, presumably like the ones you're thinking about. It's like, I haven't seen any. Like, there's a couple. I think they're decent, but nothing like massive, nothing like truly, truly disruptive. So I think it speaks to the idea that there's a little bit like probably an ideological thing, and it's like they're overestimating the appeal.
Yeah, and on the other way around, there is kind of the preconception that the platform is eating it all. And for sure, we have examples of platforms that have very high fees. Some of them need those fees to work. Some others, customers are paying it. So let's go for that. But also the traditional model could actually support a more fair distribution, probably without the need of that technology. So I wonder how much is a cultural or ideological decision and more than a technological need.
I think there's also, you have to understand, like, even the traditional platforms, I think they're not stupid. I think they understand repeated games, right? So, like, I understand a lot of regulators hate Amazon, but I'm sorry, like, Amazon provides great value for consumers. That's why consumers love it. But they're not stupid. So, of course, they understand that, for example, if they raise the fees too much relative to the value they provide, well, it's not going to go well for them. So I think that's part of it. I also think, for example, the traditional platforms, Web2 platforms, I mean, nothing prevents them from adopting, say, blockchain technologies to a certain degree, right? I mean, they can incorporate some of it. Now, you can still wonder, is there, like, I'm sure there's going to be some disruption somewhere, but it's probably not going to be as much as the blockchain maximalists or ideologues would hope. By the way, I think there will be. This will be interesting. I need to now that we discussed. I would like to go and look like what has been the development of blockchain based platforms and say over the past year. So I want to see if there's something like a new interesting platforms that have emerged.
I think the social media space is or social like the social network space is interesting.
Yes.
Yeah, because with the Twitter and now X takeover. I think there was quite a spike in Mastodon and then new platforms popping up that like labeled themselves at least as
more decentralized,
true.
Right? Yeah,
exactly.
No, it is, and you can see that's a very good candidate in some sense for decentralized platforms because they can be more. I mean, there was one, I forget the name, and I spoke with the founder. I mean, he had a really good idea. He was basically saying, we're going to create like decentralized voting system for content moderation. So post something, I don't like it. The platform is not going to decide by themselves, like I take it down or not. They're just basically, okay, there's a dispute. They randomly draw 12 users from the platform who act as a jury and who get to vote on the decision. And in order for the content to get taken down or me to be suspended, it requires like something like 2/3 majority votes. But it's all completely done by the community. It's like a jury of your peers, of users on the platform who votes on. I think it's a great mechanism. So you do it in a much more decentralized way.
I totally agree. And I think it's interesting to see how the centralized platforms try to experiment with this. And then often they introduce this in a small scale. And then TechCrunch writes about it, like the Facebook oversight board.
And yeah.
A little
true.
Bit later. You notice.
But so what happened to that?
I think it's still there, but I think there are so many.
Right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but I think this is the interesting part. I actually, even when I saw it, I didn't think much of it. And this is, I think, the interesting difference. The Facebook oversight board is basically like, it's like there's no commitment value to that. It's just basically we're going to pretend that we're going to like just like pretend that we have like, you know, we're committed, but there's no commitment value. I think what's interesting with a truly decentralized blockchain based platform, and I think that's the true value they have, that's the advantage, there's real commitment. It's basically the technology is such that you can't change it. Like you make a commitment and it's a credible commitment. It's like, I can't change the technology, that a certain amount of decisions are going to be decentralized. That, to me, that's like strip away the ideology. I think that's the most powerful source of value creation for blockchain. You can essentially encode an ideology or like a specific commitment. So like if you build a social network on the blockchain that's decentralized, you can commit to this decentralized mechanism, not this like oversight board where basically like maybe we consult them, but okay, if there's a crisis, like, no, we're going to make the decision. This is too important. Like, there's no real value, right? Like, in that regard.
I agree. But the downside is that it takes typically much longer to make the decision, to come up with what to implement, and then to change it if it doesn't work, right?
I completely agree. Yeah. So, you know, there's this the joke with the blockchain-based projects, this idea that basically you designed by committee. So obviously in the early stages, like you need to move fast. Maybe the decision was incorrect. The last thing you want is to have the committee of users to decide everything. That's crazy, right? But again, so I think that's where it's difficult. But at some point, you probably want, I mean, I guess that is the trade-off. It's very hard to get past the initial chicken and egg problem in a truly decentralized fashion. It just takes way too long. But later on, if you could, like you would want to commit to something more decentralized and more transparent.
But then you're already trapped.
But then I have the power. Why would I give it up, right? It's like, say, then it's like, I have all this control.
You know, last year we got a paper out with few colleagues and talking about the role of content creators on YouTube and how it changed over time. Trying to escaping that trap, and we saw how the more the creator becomes big, the more it tends to develop its own platform strategy, getting advertisers, going on other platforms, and things like that. And I think that story, the story you told, and again the book by Vili,
as an underlying message that is always the same. And it's kind of paradoxical in the platform world. We need to have a huge network to networks to make the multi-sided platform work. But if it goes below, above a certain threshold, the power of the platform start being super concentrated. If you go through the chapters that Billy lays out in his book, that's just incredible. No matter the vision Web2 platforms started with, after a certain dimension, problems start to arise. And so on the blockchain, probably the question is, do we have something that is big enough to have reached that that threshold? If not, you know, the foundational platforms like Ethereum or OpenSea that probably are a bit different though for the role they play.
So I'm going to make a note, and I will probably look at this book. There's a book that's seems very related, which I like, by partner Andreessen Horowitz, Chris Dixon. It's called Read, Write, Own. It's basically like blockchain. And he has he already wrote, like, there's some blogs online which you can find. And he has this very nice graph, which he shows this life cycle of platforms. So it's basically, I think it's called something, the first phase of a platform is when it's growing, it's like attracts. And then later it gets into extract. So it's like you initially have to attract people, then you get powerful, and then you start extracting, which is very nice. And it's in the book as well.
One topic that I would like to touch over the course of the last minutes we have is let's call it platform design. I really like a piece that you co-authored and just published in the Harvard Business Review. Would that marketplace succeed? I like it because my interest in platforms, particularly in B2B platforms, when I started to look into that topic in 2017, 2018, was that at the time there was this, let's call it hype around B2B being the next thing, B2B marketplaces here and there. And every B2B company wanted to build a platform / marketplace, copying the, what was it? The biggest taxi company in the world owns no taxis. And the biggest like logistics company owns no like warehouses, Amazon, you know, or Alibaba at the time. And they tried to replicate the same mechanisms. And my question basically was, what is different? And what I realized is often it's the context that they're in. And this is exactly what you describe in the paper, right? So what is a necessary condition that an area where a platform wants to be active in has to match, so that there is a way for like a marketplace to add enough value to like function and sustain. And I wonder, especially from your work with startups and also much more mature companies that want to build a platform, is there a hierarchy of these criteria that you go through, and how do you assess a potential arena, so to say, for a platform to act in?
Yes, there is. The first thought I had, it's an interesting observation. So I think what you're describing is, I guess, the failure of existing large corporations to create their own platforms, which is true. On the other hand, what I would say is, just from a pure investment standpoint, I mean, I think I'm very biased in favor of B2B marketplaces. Like there's lots of reasons for that. Like partly it's also there are few. So I think there's many more opportunities, by the way. Like there's a ton of opportunities. There's still many opportunities to do B2B marketplaces. Think about all the industries with inefficient or outdated systems where there's like many suppliers and everything, like communication is inefficient, you know, transactions are inefficient. But this is exactly, so this is actually one of the main conditions or marketplaces to add value. So I have a venture capitalist friend who always says marketplaces thrive in environments which are broken and outdated, basically. That's the idea. So like you look for a market with lots of inefficiencies. So I think there's that. The other factor is fragmentation. So I think we talked about this in the article. You want there to be lots of suppliers and buyers, right? So again, so think about supply chains with many small suppliers and many different steps along the supply chain, or like product, be it agricultural product or some good, gets transferred across many different middlemen. It's like, it's super inefficient. And usually they, you know, they use antiquated systems. That's where like having marketplaces are very useful. And I would say there's lots of promising B2B marketplaces, and there are many, many more to be built. Broken inefficient fragmentation. What else would I say? I think those are the two main ones, basically.
I think in B2B, I did some case study work and looked, for example, into a marketplace for used wind turbines. So the biggest marketplace for used wind turbines in Europe.
How many buyers and sellers of wind turbines are there?
many, because it's typically like people who have a lot of land. So like farmers, for example. Farmers then put the wind turbines on their land.
Okay, and buyers, those would be the buyers, right?
But could also be the sellers. So they buy them new because it's used.
Oh, so secondhand market, ICS. That's interesting. That's interesting. I didn't think of that. Yeah, that's good.
What they still have to do is a lot of like traditional B2B sales operations, right? They need to reach out to these farmers. They need to find them. They need to explain, this is the marketplace. This is how you, I don't know, assess the value of your machine, you know, all these things. And I think this is something that is, yeah, tough.
I think I guess it depends on the, when you say B2B, who exactly is the B? And you're right. If it's farmers, upper, I think one advantage, I mean, it depends on the sophistication. I think that one of the advantages with B2B is if the customers on either side are businesses, they tend to be, I mean, if they know what we're talking about, like they're more rational. Like consumers like tend to make somewhat irrational decisions to adopt a product or a platform. But for businesses, if you say, listen, come to this marketplace and your sales are going to improve by X percent or something like that, you can have a more rational conversation about like joining the platform. So I think that can be an advantage of building B2B marketplaces relative to consumer facing.
Well, we mentioned some of your recent work, and I would say we talked about some possible ideas for future work. But beside those ideas, going towards an end, what's in your pipeline, or what are hot topics you see in the world of platforms that worth to be investigated?
So Platform Trap, we're still working on that. I think there's definitely lots of interesting aspects of Platform Traps. Again, I think we need to be very clear in the paper. This is not a paper for regulators. This is more interesting to think about like various ways in which the Platform Trap is created, and possibly, for example, for the implication for, say, potential sellers on a platform to avoid the Platform Trap. So I think there's lots of stuff to be done there. Actually, decentralized platforms, like using blockchain or not, I think that's a very interesting topic. Definitely, like it's definitely something where we want to explore. In fact, so we're working with this editor from Harvard Business Review. So we've been working with him for a while, like many of our articles have been with him. And we had discussed like doing an article for Harvard Business Review on decentralized platforms. I think we still want to do that. Usually we try to do a Harvard Business Review and then an academic article on the same topic. So I think we'll definitely move in that direction. I think these are the main topics we're working on now. There's also the other one, which is maybe not as closely related to platforms, is on artificial intelligence. So competition policy and artificial intelligence. I guess the only relationship is that we also worry about network effects. It's a different type of network effects when you think about data-enabled learning than the network effect that's present on platforms.
I think this becomes particularly interesting if you combine it with the decentralized platforms, and then really starting to think about like centralizing effect of AI and the benefit that you get from collecting lots of data.
That's a really good point. Yes. It's interesting, right? So blockchain is a move towards decentralization. AI is towards massive centralization. Yeah, that's a really good point.
All right, Andre. We are already at the end for today's episode. I can only say thank you so much. It was a like great discussion, a great conversation. I think we had touched many different topics, but I think we didn't really like lose a nice like path to through the world of multi-sided marketplaces that you have been influencing so greatly in your academic career so far. But thank you so much, and yeah, just the best for your upcoming work.
Yeah, thank you. That was really fun. Thank you both for inviting me.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Talking About Platforms. You can rate the podcast on every major podcast app. This helps us a lot in growing.
Visit talkingaboutplatforms.com to get the links of the short notes, reach out to us, and see the previous episodes.
Hear you in another episode to talk about platforms.